which appeared in Evangelical Quarterly. That is the most distinguished theological journal from an evangelical standpoint published in England, Evangelical Quarterly. It's been around for about 75 years. And this article appeared in Volume 75, Issue 3, in 2003.
Okay.
Yes?
I don't know if you want to put it on.
Oh, that's not a half bad idea. Sure. Yes. Reference to an article on presuppositionalism by John J. Johnson. John J. Johnson. I hope his middle name isn't also John. That would be unfortunate. There is the instance, very sad instance, of Jeffrey. The rector stuttered when he was christened. It was a very, very sad situation. This article is entitled, "Is Cornelius Van Til's Apologetic Method Christian or Merely Theistic?" Is Cornelius Van Til's Apologetic Method Christian or Merely Theistic? And this appeared in the Evangelical Quarterly, Volume 75, Number 3, in 2003. The argument of the author is that even if the presuppositionalist says to the non-Christian, your use of logic and your use of inductive method derive from Christian faith, and you don't realize that you're living off of the capital of another viewpoint, even if you don't understand this, we'll do this for the fun of it, and we will see where this leads you. Says Johnson, at very best, all this would do is to lead the non-Christian to some kind of theistic worldview. There has to be a source for logic and the consistency of the world and the existence of the world and stuff like that. And therefore, even at very best, that argument that the non-Christian has to rely on ideas that can't come from his own viewpoint, that have to come from the existence of God, would not take him to the cross of Christ at all. This wouldn't take him to the incarnation or anything roughly resembling it. The very best it could possibly do is to convince the non-Christian that unless there is some absolute, he wouldn't be able to rely upon any kind of solid method for what he's doing. So the thing is only theistic. That is, it can't get any farther than to say there is an absolute source of the world, an absolute source of logic and inductive reasoning. A presuppositionalist answered this in a later issue of the Evangelical Quarterly. Johnson endeavored to reply, but Evangelical Quarterly apparently thought they'd had enough of this and didn't accept the rejoinder. And we did for the Global Journal of Classical Theology. That's the online journal, which is now a subsite of Patrick Henry's. So if you'd like to read the final comment of Johnson on all this, you can do so by going to the Global Journal. And that is simply a subsite of the Patrick Henry website. Yes, today we are devoting the period to the second session on epistemology. We're going to conclude our discussion of epistemology today, and we're going to do this by way of Proposition 2 of the Tractatus. So, if you have your copy of the Tractatus there, that can help you immensely. At the beginning of Proposition 2, which is the epistemological proposition, we say that there are a number of so-called methods for finding truth that actually beg the question, meaning they already assume some understanding of truth, and therefore they are not legitimate methods for obtaining truth. And we give several examples of this. So-called common sense. There's some wonderful passages in John Mortimer's Rumpole stories, the stories of this crusty English barrister. And Rumpole is there before this Scottish judge, and the Scottish judge constantly says, "But it isn't common sense, Rumpole." And by common sense, the judge always means his own viewpoint. And you will notice that people who use the common sense argument are using this as a rationalization to support what they happen to think. If it were really common sense, everybody would agree with it. So it certainly is not an adequate test for truth. Intuition. Now, we all know that some people appear to be more intuitive than others. The concept of women's intuition is a valid concept. There is a much greater sensitivity on the part of women in general. We men go around as obtuse clods, missing all sorts of subtexts. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, intuition needs to be tested from outside, because there are a lot of intuitive statements that, as a matter of fact, are not correct. Intuition then begs the question. You're going to have to test what a person says is intuitively correct, just as you have to test something where the individual says, "This is common sense." How about authority? Authority. The church is an authority, or the grand poobah is authority, or whatever. Well, that again begs the question. You've got to test not only whether this is an authority, but whether what he says is correct. Because even the great authorities can make mistakes and do make mistakes. It's very interesting that in the Roman Catholic Church, the infallibility of the Pope is very, very carefully delimited. The Pope's statements are only infallible when the Pope speaks on a matter of faith and doctrine ex cathedra, that is, from the chair and officially. That is, so, if the Pope says, "These are the best scrambled eggs in the world, having had a wonderful breakfast," that statement, even by Roman Catholic doctrine, is not necessarily infallible. See? And so the Church recognizes that even when it comes to papal authority, you're going to have to define this pretty closely to make sure that that it doesn't create immense difficulties. Authority, again, always needs to be tested from the outside. But you say, suppose it's a matter of God's authority. Huh? You certainly wouldn't need to test that from outside. Right. But the problem there is to establish that in a given instance, that is what in fact God said. Right? What about the mystic who says, lo, God holds to the following. Well, how do you know that the mystic has some kind of special pipeline to the divine such that he can make statements like this? And if we say, well, this is easily solved, the Bible, that's God's authority. Well, it is the presentation of the very Word of God. But a person who doesn't believe this, a person outside of the Christian faith, will need to have some evidence to show that that is indeed divine authority as compared with any number of other so-called holy books. Because the Muslims are saying exactly the same thing about the Quran. Baha'i is saying the same thing about the utterances of Baha'u'llah on around the block. Surely we can't just assume that it is the Word of God. Did you have a question? I noticed you trembling back there.
I was just trying to figure out the distinction between the the common sense of a normal person and the authoritative part of it, wouldn't that be just simply the common sense of somebody who's an authority? What classifies them as an authority?
Well, these are separate tests for truth, really. We're not saying the common sense of an authority. We're saying common sense as presented by anybody, right?
Wouldn't the wisdom of an authority simply, like, if you're looking at it, wouldn't that be just his common sense?
Well, it could very well be. Could very well be. Now, if this is, let us say, a specialist in computer technology, and that person states something about the problem with your computer, the chances are that that isn't just common sense. It probably derives from the fact that he is a specialist in this area. He's an authority in that area. But even there, you wouldn't accept this as necessarily an absolute truth, particularly if it's going to cost you $1,500 to when he repairs your computer. Chances are you're going to go and check this out with somebody else. There will be, in other words, a test beyond the mere fact that he asserts that this is the problem. Authoritative statements still need to be checked. That's what we're saying. We're saying in each of these cases, common sense, intuition, etc., they still need to be tested. And if they still need to be tested, you can't say that they are a final test for truth. They beg the question, namely the truth question. The truth question is still there. All right. What about religious experience? Well, all over the place you find people claiming that religious experience, this is 2.15, all over the place you find that religious experience is being presented as a final authority. But this is a real problem. The fact is that before you allow religious experience as an authority, you have assumed what constitutes genuine religious experience. So this is circular. The people who do this already have an idea of what they think is valid religious experience, so they only listen to that. The religious liberal, for example, will not listen to the religious experience of the fundamentalist, and the fundamentalist will not listen to the religious experience of the liberal. The Muslim will not listen to Christian religious experience. But what about faith? What about faith? Maybe that's the final authority in itself. What about faith? 2.17, next page. Same problem as with religious experience. What constitutes genuine faith? You're going to have some sort of test that will establish that ahead of time. And it gets even more complicated with faith because faith doesn't automatically have any content. You can use the term so that it does. You can talk about the faith, meaning a particular religious position. But if we're talking about faith as such, this is an attitude or a personal rapprochement with some religious position. Some years ago, there was a book published entitled The Magic of Believing. Listen, there isn't any magic in believing as such. It depends upon what you believe in. You know, believing in the great pumpkin, along the lines of Peanuts, the Peanuts cartoon, believing in the great pumpkin is not going to accomplish much. And the reason for this is that, the great pumpkin's not going to do a lot for you. It depends upon the object of the faith rather than the process of the faith as such. It was a very important article published by a non-Christian, Kay Nielsen. This is 21715. This article is entitled, Can Faith Validate God Talk? Can Faith Validate God Talk? That was published in an anthology of articles entitled New Theology Number 1. The full citation of this is given in other works of mine. The Tractatus does not have footnoting because it's paralleled stylistically Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and it forces people to other writings of mine to get bibliographical material. That's pretty clever, I thought. Anyway, but this article is superb in showing that merely believing something doesn't validate the objective truth of it, which should be obvious anyway, but it's amazing how in religious circles people take the view that if there is enough warm faith, then what they're saying must be true. Fiddlesticks. And you can see also the problem when you line up 10 people and they are all serious believers, but they're all seriously believing in 10 different and mutually contradictory positions. They might all be wrong, but they certainly can't all be right. So the faith, again, has to be tested from the outside to determine whether or not it is legitimate and valid. Okay, so there are a number of so-called tests of religious truth which are not tests at all, which themselves have to be tested. Okay, on to 2.2. And 2.3. 2.2 and 2.3. 2.2 and 2.3 simply point out that everybody has to use formal logic and inductive method to investigate the world. Everybody has to do this. By formal logic, we mean that reasoning which follows from the law of non-contradiction. A cannot be non-A at the same time under the same conditions. Formal or deductive logic is something that nobody can avoid. Now, this is unprovable because you couldn't very well demonstrate logic except by using it. So, this is an unprovable starting point, but it's one that everybody has to employ, and everybody does. The people who try to argue against logic are already using it. Same goes for inductive method. How do you learn what the world consists of? How do you know that there are elephants out there and there are not leprechauns or whatever? Well, you go out and you investigate. You collect facts. You hypothesize as to the explanation of these facts. You test your hypotheses by more investigation. And you keep refining that kind of process until you get a reasonably accurate picture of the world. Everybody does this. The people who deny that inductive method needs to be used, the minute they begin presenting evidence that it shouldn't be used, are already using it. They're collecting data to show you that inductive method does not need to be used. But that is inductive method, for goodness sake. Now, if this is so, if everybody has to use induction to find out what the world is like, and they all have to use formal logic in order to put this stuff together and draw conclusions from it, then we certainly do have a way of identifying whether something is true or not. Edgar Sheffield Brightman of Boston University, the philosopher of the mid-20th century, set out a test for truth which he calls systematic consistency. Systematic consistency. Systematic, in his terms, meant fitting the facts of the world. That's the inductive side of it. And consistency has to do with the internal logic of what's being said. That's the deductive side of it. That's the formal logic side of it. What Brightman is saying is that ideally a true statement is going to be internally consistent and it's going to fit the facts of the world. All right. In general, then, what you have here is an understanding of truth as correspondence with reality. Something is true if it corresponds to the way the cosmic cookie actually crumbles, rather than the way you might want it to crumble. Proposition 2.383. Arguments against the correspondence view of truth leave it untouched. Correspondence is the best way of describing a true statement. A true statement is one that corresponds to reality. Now, there are philosophers who have attempted to argue against this. What they say is this: how can this be a test for truth, correspondence with reality, when you're relating two entirely different things? That is to say, you have an idea in your mind, and you are saying that that idea corresponds to reality outside your mind. These philosophers say, ah, but you can't get the reality outside inside your mind to make a valid comparison. What you're doing is comparing something going on inside you with something going on outside you, but you can never get both of these on the same plane. Now, is this a valid criticism of the correspondence theory? Hardly. Why? Because employing induction and deduction, as any correspondence notion does, correspondence turns out to be necessitarian. Everybody has to do this. We all do this. We all assume that there is an external world out there and that we are around making an analysis of what's going on. And this is true of everybody. The philosopher who criticizes the correspondence theory is nevertheless assuming that he can deal with external data, though he can't get the external data stuffed into his noggin. The problem is exactly the same for him. There is, in other words, an underlying assumption that there can be a correlation between the world outside and the world of reasoning that goes on inside of people's heads. That is unprovable entirely. But everyone does this and everybody has to do it. Yes? Just a little bit louder. There's this heating system is obscuring you.
Descartes, is that what he was arguing against or for? I can't remember.
Well, Descartes, a rationalist philosopher of the 17th century, Descartes set forth the possibility of God as an evil genius. Now, he did not believe that God was an evil genius, but he said, What about the argument that God could be deceiving us? In other words, that the world outside was very different from the world that we imagined it to be. Or that the whole business is a dream in the mind of God and there isn't any actual world here at all. God is the evil genius. Descartes is only presenting this as a logical problem. And the reason that it's important to him is that as a pure rationalist, he wants to deduce everything, as one does in mathematics or pure logic, and he does not want to have problems with the empirical world around him while he's doing this. Now, what is the answer to the evil genius situation? Well, if God were a cosmic trickster, if he were, he would be much better at tricking than you would be at detective work to catch him at it. Right? So he would always win in such situations. Thus, this is a completely nonsensical discussion. You could never catch him at it anyway, so there's no point whatsoever in trying to raise the question. This isn't right. It isn't even wrong. There's no way to confirm or disconfirm a statement like this. We have to assume that the world is a legitimate reality outside of us and that we are in existence and that when we investigate the world and formulate an understanding of it, that the correspondence is legitimate. And this isn't really a gigantic problem, particularly since everybody has to do it. See, and this is so important to realize that any valid epistemology has got to work across the board. One of the problems with some Christian believers is that they give the impression to the non-Christian that there is some special technique of finding truth that only Christians know. And nobody else really can do this. There is the strange evangelical theologian Witness Lee. Have you ever messed around with Witness Lee? And there's Nee and Lee, and they are related in some fashion. It's Witness Lee and... what's Nee's first name? Yeah, something like that. Well, Watchman Nee and Witness Lee. Yes. Well, these two are favorite readings of a certain pietistic element in evangelicalism. Okay, and they maintain, Nee and Lee, that you've got to have the mind of Christ, the nous, they use the Greek word for mind in the New Testament, you've got to have that in order to understand truth in any sense of the word. Non-Christian can't understand truth at all because he doesn't have this nous, this special quality. Now, what's the trouble with this? The trouble is that it leaves the non-Christian completely out in left field. You can well imagine that if this is presented to a non-Christian, the non-Christian is not going to be in a position to consider the case for Christianity at all. It sort of parallels the Calvinist idea, although these two are not Calvinists at all, but it sort of parallels the Calvinist idea that there's if you're non-elect, if you have suffered from the negative side of double predestination, there is just no hope because God's decision is already made in regard to you. I think this is, I mean, not only is it bad philosophically, it is a mess theologically, a real mess. Okay, now, correspondence theory of truth. We all go with it. Incidentally, it is present throughout Scripture. And in proposition, where is it here someplace? Yeah, in proposition 2.38412, We give a whole series of biblical references showing that in Scripture, truth is regarded as that which corresponds to reality. Okay, but anyway, everybody uses this. Everybody. What about the argument, however, which is presented in philosophical circles quite frequently, that instead of taking a correspondence view of truth, we should take a coherence view of truth? Something is true if it is coherent. That is, the best worldviews are those that have the greatest degree of coherence about them. What do we mean by coherence? Well, that can mean one of two things. It can mean either internal consistency, or it can mean internal consistency as the majority factor and fitting the facts of the world as a minority consideration. If the second, if it is really a combination of both internal consistency and a fitting of the facts, it's similar to what Brightman is saying, and it's really not essentially different from what we've been talking about. But if by coherence is meant, as long as the view is aesthetically consistent, looks good, all the pieces fit together nicely in the viewpoint, it must be true. That surely is not the case. We've already made the point that the great paranoics are very consistent and very coherent in their viewpoint. Remember Uncle Oscar. I mentioned Uncle Oscar to you, the one who's followed by Albanians. He is absolutely consistent. This is a coherent worldview from his standpoint, that he is always followed by Albanians. They may not look like Albanians, taste or smell like Albanians, but they really are. Now, coherence in itself, if we mean logical consistency, is not enough. All right. Proposition 2.4. What about the philosophical argument that we shouldn't be starting from being as we have been? We shouldn't be starting from principles that are solid and absolute, like the laws of logic and inductive method, but instead we should be starting from the notion of becoming. Now you say, "What? I don't understand. What are we doing with this stuff?" Well, in the history of Western philosophy, one of the great themes has been whether or not you begin from a single absolute, from a starting point that is an absolute, firm and solid point, or whether everything is in fact in flux, and you've got to begin with the concept of flux. The pre-Socratic philosophers, those before Socrates, some of them at least, presented this idea of becoming as a fundamental category. In Plato, the argument is presented that you cannot do that. You must begin with being, with some kind of absolute, rather than beginning with the flux of experience. One pre-Socratic philosopher said, "You can't step into the same river twice," meaning that the river is not the same the next time you step into it. Everything is changing. Indeed, you are not the same. You are a bit different the next time that you step into the river. The argument here is that what is really fundamental is change. Change is fundamental. Today, process philosophers and process theologians are saying this kind of thing. Everything is in process. Everything is in motion, in movement. And you've got to start there. Well, what about that? Logically, you cannot start with flux. You can't start with change. And why can't you start there? Because you cannot identify anything. The minute you start identifying, you are isolating, and that carries you right back to being instead of becoming. Example, the Hegelian dialectic. Remember the Hegelian dialectic? Little bugs and so forth? Yes, you remember the Hegelian dialectic. Okay, Hegel believed that he had found a new logic, a logic of becoming, as opposed to classical logic, which is based upon the law of non-contradiction. Hegel presents a logic of change, of motion. Thesis produces antithesis. The two struggle together and you get a synthesis, and that becomes a new thesis, and so on. It's a logic of continual change, isn't it? But look at it for a moment. If we were really beginning with flux and change, we wouldn't be able to distinguish the thesis from the antithesis, or the two of them from the synthesis. You first of all got to be able to define a thesis in such a way that it isn't the antithesis at the same time under the same conditions. You've got to use the law of non-contradiction in order to know that you're dealing with a thesis and not with something else. All notions of becoming or change require some kind of absolute analysis underlying them to identify the elements that go into the process. Someone says to you, all is relative. The proper response to this is, what about that statement? Is that statement relative? If the statement all is relative is also relative, then, of course, you can't rely on it. That the person who says this is assuming that he has just stated an absolute, namely, all is relative. Huh? So that even relativistic statements require an underlying absolute, in quotes, to make any sense out of them. Yes. All right. Go to proposition 2.5. The hermeneutical circle. What, you say, could that possibly be? What's a hermeneutical circle? Well, in modern philosophy, especially in variations of existential philosophy, the following assertion is made. You can never get at objective truth because you as the interpreter are locked in to the process. There is no such thing as a purely objective observation of the world. When you look at the world, you influence the situation by your own presence. The hermeneutical circle, then, the circle, is one which interlocks interlocks the subject, you, with the object, what you are observing. Okay? This thing goes around and around. You can never, according to the argument, you can never look at an object. You can never look at the world in pure objectivity because you yourself are always locked into it yourself. You can't read a book and get a purely objective interpretation of it. You as the interpreter will impact what you're reading and color it. The object and the subject then work on each other. Each influences the other, and you never... So the arrows here go both ways on the circle. It follows, therefore, that you can never get a purely objective view of things, and you never can arrive at the truth. Well, what do we say to that? There's no doubt about the fact that we tend to color our understanding of the world by our own prejudices. There's no doubt about that. But we try desperately to analyze our own prejudices and put them aside so as to get a more and more accurate view of the world. When we read a book, particularly a book by someone we disagree with, we try our best to understand what that person is saying and not let our own subjectivity color what is actually being said. It is a mark of maturity to get to the point where you can identify your own prejudices and tendencies and make them of less and less importance. All investigations of the world try to put the subjectivity of the investigator to one side as much as possible so as to get an accurate view of the world. We may not be able to reach this 100%, but for goodness sake, that's the ideal, and that's what we are striving for. And the trouble with the hermeneutical circle is it sort of lies down and immaturely accepts the notion that you can never get anywhere because you are necessarily part of the world that you're observing. I have a couple of cute illustrations to show that this notion is most unfortunate. Robert Benchley, the American humorist, said that he had spent his entire high school biology course drawing the reflection of his own eyelash as it fell onto the microscope slide. You know, he had not held his eye in the proper position, so the microscope picked up his own eyelashes, and instead of drawing what was on the slide, he was drawing his own eyelashes. Now, the reason that that is funny is that we can certainly avoid this, and we know perfectly well we need to avoid it. Purpose of a biology course, for goodness sake, is not autobiography. It isn't to look at your own eyelash. It's to distinguish yourself from what you're observing. Okay, another illustration. In the 18th century, an Italian astronomer by the name of Schiaparelli first identified the canali on Mars. Now, in Italian, canalo is a ditch. Our word canal comes from this, and from Schiaparelli's work, the idea of canals on Mars came into the picture. And everybody was talking about, you know, the fact that there are Martians doing canals on Mars. It has been suggested that the source of this was incipient cataract in Schiaparelli's own eye. His own eyes. When he was looking at Mars, instead of seeing canals on Mars, this was a reflection of the cataract that he had in his own eye. Again, this is not how you properly do science, and most people would recognize this, and the hermeneutical circle must not be used to baptize this sort of thing. 2.8, proposition 2.8. What happens if, in terms of Brightman's systematic consistency, you get a situation where something fits the world factually, a concept fits the world factually, but it isn't internally consistent? What happens if it lacks inner consistency? Or the reverse? What happens if something is internally beautifully consistent internally, and it doesn't fit the facts very well? What do you do when you don't have a nice situation in which things are both internally consistent and fitting the facts? Well, I suggest that in a conflict between the two of these, you go with the facts in preference to going with internal consistency. Why? Well, you know the adage, life is bigger than logic, in the sense that the world is very large and very mysterious, and we can very well come across things in the world, and we do, where clearly that's the way it is, but we can't seem to understand how those things work rationally. We mustn't, under those circumstances, try to shove the data under the rug and ignore it. We've got to go with the data, even if we can't understand fully how to put all those data together in a nice, clean theory. An example is the nature of light. Light has can be analyzed as corpuscular, and it can be analyzed as undulatory. It's wave and particle at the same time. Problem being that waves aren't particles and particles aren't waves. This is not a consistent notion. But the scientist goes with the facts, and he hypothesizes the photon. The photon is a unit of light, and it's defined as a wave hyphen particle. Okay? So, if we have a tension between the facts and the internal ability to put these into a rational system, we will certainly go with the facts. The upshot of all of this, of the discussion we've engaged in, is Proposition 2.9, we need a verifiability principle. And that's the one we were talking about last time. Verifiability principle says simply that if a viewpoint cannot state any way by which it can be proven or disproven, forget it. Don't bother with it. It's not worth the energy. Any viewpoint worth talking about will have some means, at least in principle, of confirming it or disconfirming it. And as we'll see when we get to the unit on philosophy of religion, only Christian faith passes this test. Only Christian faith passes this test. We'll show you how when we get to that point. Now, finally, and I've got a couple of minutes here, we've been talking about how to get at truth. As a Christian believer, you are likely to say, wait a minute, all of this is irrelevant because truth is personal and truth is a relationship with Jesus Christ. And there are a lot of pietistic evangelicals and even not so pietistic evangelicals who take that kind of approach. How does what we've just been saying relate to that? Answer. In terms of classical theology, for goodness sake. Classically, the concept of Christian truth has been understood as three levels of a pyramid. Make yourself a pyramid in your note. Yes. At the bottom level of the pyramid, you have facts or knowledge. In Latin, notitia, N-O-T-I-T-I-A, notitia. Notitia translates out as facts or knowledge. The next level up is fides, F-I-D-E-S, faith, in the sense of public commitment. And at the top of the pyramid is fiducia, F-I-D-U-C-I-A. F-I-D-U-C-I-A, that is faith in the sense of trust, confidence, the personal relationship. In classical theology, things start with what God has factually done. He has factually revealed himself through prophets and